The Subcommittee on Criminal Law. Welcome all of you here today. We are going to begin today with House Bill 2413, and I will open a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. My staff is bringing testimony down. I think I'm probably the only one going to talk on that bill. Do you want to go to that next?
We'll hold on that.
Thank
then.
You.
We will, in that case. The chair would open the hearing, the public hearing on House Bill 2420.
Thank you, counsel.
Oh my God, we're into February already.
And I would ask to have both panel members come forward on House Bill 2420, Dale Penn and Bill Hauser.
May I agree?
No, they don't agree.
I like this team approach.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to go ahead while we're at it, because my guess is you prepared remarks that address both 2420 and 2419 at the same time. I will go ahead and open a public hearing also on House Bill 2419, and then ask you if you wish, you can direct your remarks to both bills because of their similarity. And I will start with Mr. Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Both of these bills, 2419 and 2420, attempt to accomplish the same goal. And I would say that in testifying on these bills that I've talked with representatives of the Chiefs of Police Association, the State Sheriff's Association, Oregon State Police. They are very supportive of both of these bills. Last session, some of you will recall that there was a bill that started out very similar to 2419, but what it said was is that methamphetamine has had such a tremendous impact on our society, not just in the lives of the people that utilize methamphetamine and they destroy their lives, destroy their jobs, destroy their marriages, but all of the other spin-offs from that impact on those families, on those broken marriages, on the jobs that are lost and the poor workmanship that is done in industry. And so methamphetamine, unfortunately, has developed into a terrible drug of choice in the state of Oregon. And we have become a manufacturing site for methamphetamine. And Oregon and the West Coast of the United States has really been, unfortunately, the leader in the United States in methamphetamine growth. When I talk to drug enforcement teams in the state of Oregon, we look at the intelligence information on the use and manufacture of illegal drugs in the state of Oregon, what we find is over 60% of the intelligence information on narcotics in this state relates to methamphetamine manufacture. Recently, Oregon has been designated as a high-intensity drug trafficking area by the federal government. Marion County, Deschutes County, I forget the third county, I apologize, were highlighted as those HIDA sites, high intensity. Clackamas County? Okay. And presently, as I understand it, in the new federal budget, nine other counties in Oregon are going to be designated, or six other counties, so we'd have a total of nine counties designated by the federal government as high-intensity drug trafficking areas in the United States. And a big reason for that is the growth of manufacturing of methamphetamine and the scourge that methamphetamine has become in our society. Consequently, last session there was an effort to strengthen our penalties for the manufacture of methamphetamine. not the possession, not the use, but the manufacture of methamphetamine. And I neglected to talk about one other impact that we see in our state because of the manufacture. Typically, these formulas change dramatically, and they are very easy to create and to manufacture, create labs, and we see very toxic residue from that manufacture. And people will rent a room in a hotel and manufacture methamphetamine and then render that room and accompanying rooms unsafe until they have been decontaminated. And this is a very expensive process and very detrimental to the health of our community. At any rate, there was an effort to try to strengthen the penalties. Right now, the manufacture of methamphetamine is a level 8 crime if there are at least 10 grams of methamphetamine involved in the manufacturing process. Now, if we find a lab that the manufacturing process has been completed, so that we're talking about a residue lab, it is more typically going to be a Category 4 under sentencing guidelines. Now, I have brought a little chart of sentencing guidelines, and the reason this becomes significant is if you look at Category 8 crimes, the lower level of Category 8 allows for what is called optional probation. And it allows that in the three lowest categories, people with the least amount of criminal history, the presumptive prison sentence would be from 16 months to 22 months for manufacture of substantial quantities of methamphetamine, but they qualify, or they could qualify, for probation. And so what happens in those cases is a judge is going to make a determination, should I give you probation or should I give you somewhere between 16 to 22 months in prison? And remember that someone who's sentenced under sentencing guidelines, typically they're going to receive a 15% reduction for good time, possibly up to 20%. So that when you talk about even the 22-month prison sentence, that is really something along the lines of 18 months. That is not a very, and particularly when you have the capability of probation, we do not believe that is a sufficient deterrent sentence for manufacturing methamphetamine, given the evils this drug has brought to our state. There was an effort to step up the penalties all the way across the board, but unfortunately, any time you do that, it has a significant financial impact. And so, ultimately, the last days of the session, last session, House Bill 2419 was in its present writing, I guess, or form, and it had been cut down significantly so that it reduced the fiscal impact to $56,000. What it does is to say that in these lower categories of Category 8, manufacturing of methamphetamine, optional probation will not be possible. Okay? So that instead, for manufacturing methamphetamine, the lowest presumptive prison sentence would be 16 months, and it would be presumed to be a prison sentence all the way along the grid. The top one for the most severe criminal record would be 45 months. Now, that does not mean that the court would not have discretion. This is not a mandatory sentence, or it is not a mandatory minimum. It simply says optional probation is not possible. The judge still has the capability, given the facts and the circumstances and the facts of the offender, to depart up or depart down if there were sufficient, substantial and compelling reasons to justify departure. So I don't want anyone to misinterpret this to be a mandatory minimum sentence. It is not. It simply says the presumptive sentence will be prison. There is not a possibility of probation unless there is departure down. Okay. So that's what this bill does. It was significantly carved down and reduced to reduce the fiscal impact of this $56,000, and that's House Bill 2419. 2420 is very similar, but it simply adds that there are salts and isomers and other salts of the isomers. This is just a legal description of some of the components of the formulas for methamphetamine. So it broadens a little bit the formula. And the difficulty is that almost monthly you will see on the internet even new formulas to create methamphetamine. And it is very difficult to keep up to the newest processes, and we will attempt, and we have attempted, to go after the precursor chemicals to create methamphetamine. And when you start enforcement against one, a new formula comes up and a new precursor is used. But this is just a small broadening to get at some of these precursors, salts and isomers of methamphetamine. So that's the reason for the bill. At some point in the next few weeks, law enforcement and others, DEQ and others, would like to present to you a better overview of some of the impact of methamphetamine in our state. I know that each of you have had contacts with constituents and have your own issues about how difficult methamphetamine has become for our state. But this is a very small effort to perhaps take a philosophical statement that manufacturing of methamphetamine in Oregon will be a presumptive prison sentence. And that's what these bills do.
Thank you very much, Mr. Penn. I have asked that they come forward and give us a more full presentation, probably taking the majority of one of our committee meetings, on the current status of the methamphetamine problem, what actions that are being taken, and frankly, committee, for us to maybe think the idea of what kinds of creative ways we could find to sort of help law enforcement address this serious problem. In Mr. Hauser, before I go to you, it is customary and courtesy to give a visiting colleague the opportunity to come forward and speak to their bill. So, Representative Jensen, if you'd like to come forward and speak to these issues so we can get you back doing whatever it is you've got to do this morning.
Thank you very much, Chair Williams, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning on House Bills 2419 and 2420. I think you've just heard a very good discussion and description of those bills, and it wouldn't be my intention to, attempt to enlarge upon that. I do think, though, it is one additional small tool that may be in our arsenal to try to deal with what is, I believe, one of the growing and largest problems, criminal problems, that we have in the United States. And I would just urge the committee to move favorably in this direction on this bill, or these bills. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd answer any questions if anyone...
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for Representative Jensen? Great. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Hauser.
Thank you, Chair Williams. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. In my remarks, I'd like to explain a little bit about some of the basics of what we do when we get a client who might be charged with something like manufacturing of methamphetamine and dealing with that person in that particular case. Clearly, we're not going to be coming here and saying that methamphetamine is a good thing. In fact, in my opinion, it's probably the worst drug that we have out there today. And that includes the heroin and LSD and some of the other things that really mess people up. This messes people up probably worse than anything else that I've seen on a person-to-person basis, talking with individuals using the drug. But oftentimes when we have someone who is charged with manufacturing of methamphetamine, we have to go to them and say, here is the evidence against you. And very often, because of the effect, they're usually users as well. The effect of the drug on that individual is that they don't believe us, because we suddenly become the other prosecutor in the courtroom. We are no longer their friend when we tell them that there is bad things out there awaiting them. So what we do when we talk about the optional probation and we talk about the different options they have, and they have, the state has a strong case against them, say, we say one of the things that you have defending yourself is that you can ask the court for an optional probationary period of time for the manufacturer that you're going to be going down on. And that gives them some reason for hope, frankly. It gives us a tool to use, not with necessarily the district attorneys, but with our clients in order to resolve cases. It is our belief that if we take that away, there will be more emphasis on from our clients to us that we will have to defend potentially more trials for that type of charge. So from our perspective, it's not necessarily that we think that methamphetamine is a good thing and we should give our clients a break, but we use that as a tool in defense in order to get those folks down, hopefully, that road of rehabilitation. Not always, but hopefully that is our goal. And so that's the perspective that we come to this discussion with.
Thank you, Mr. Hauser. I've got a couple of questions I guess I'd like to talk over with both of you. Mr. Penn, in a situation typically is it where you're prosecuting somebody for the manufacture of meth, are the manufacturers also typically users? Do you find a great distinction between someone who's actually using versus someone who's manufacturing? Are they usually cooking this stuff because they're also participants in its use?
Mr. Chair, it is difficult for me to answer that question, and I will say that certainly there are some that are only in this for money, and they manufacture and they stay away from it. There are always a number of manufacturers that utilize some of their drug, and this becomes a very difficult drug because it makes people feel like they're very powerful and they tend to arm themselves, and so it becomes very dangerous. But so certainly there are manufacturers who use. The difficulty is trying to make a statement that we are not trying to do anything with possession and even sale here. We're only talking about manufacture, and that's what this is focused on.
Mr. Hauser?
My experience is probably a little bit more limited than Mr. Penn's concerning dealing with the manufacturers, because I only deal with them as I get them as their attorney, and my experience is that most of the people who deliver and most of the people who manufacture also use. A percentage, I can't tell you, but that's my experience.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting, at the very beginning of the session, we had a gentleman from the National Institute of Justice, whose name was Ed Zaleski. And one of the things that I remember Ed talking about in his presentation was that in rehabilitation situations, they've determined that meth users take about twice the amount of time as other drug users to rehabilitate. And so one of my problems with the concept of probation being sort of an opportunity is that it seems to me that their best chance for rehabilitation is probably some program of incarceration that mandates their stop using the drug. And I worry about whether or not probation has the ability to exert those same sort of controls. Do you want to respond?
Well, obviously, when someone's out in the community, it's easier to get a drug.
Yeah.
And the probationary terms that I've seen given out for any kind of drug offense also includes the requirement that they go through drug treatment. And it's always or usually an outpatient drug treatment program where they have urinalysis testing and searches,
right,
and seizures. Do they successfully complete? No, there's a lot of people that fall off the wagon and go back.
And get revoked, and then their probation gets revoked,
right. Yeah.
And then they're in.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll pause just for a moment to allow Representative Winters an opportunity to speak to these bills. Just for your information, Representative Winters, both of the witnesses seated by you have addressed the bills, and Representative Jensen also came forward and addressed the bills.
Thank you. I won't take up much of your time. I'm Jackie Winters, state representative from District 31, and this is a bill that we introduced last session, and it passed both the House and the Senate. It was sent back to committee on a technicality, and we were not able to revisit the bill before sine die. In fact, if I recall, the bill came back, and we didn't hit within 24 hours, and so it was a time issue. I bring this bill back before this session. It was overwhelmingly supported the last legislative session. If you followed some of the events that have been happening in our community since last session, you will note, particularly I noted in Coos Bay, that we still have the issue of methamphetamine manufacturing in the state. We still have the issue of a high increase in child abuse in this state. And when I have spoken to some of those who are involved with the child abuse neglect cases, the services to children and families, they paint a direct correlation between the methamphetamine use and the rise in child abuse in the state. The bill does not provide a penalty for the user. It was my intent to begin to get at those individuals who are manufacturing in our state and to send a signal that we in Oregon do not welcome the manufacturing of methamphetamine. It is the one drug, and talking to those that are involved in the issue of drugs like my good friend over here, Dale Penn, that it's the one drug that's violent. You know, unlike when we talk about the marijuana use, or we talk about cocaine and the heroin use, which is a lot more, as I understand it, since I don't use it, it's a more mellowing effect than the methamphetamine. When you talk to the judges in the courts, they will tell you that they can tell the difference between the individual who comes before them who has been a meth user and those who are on the other drug, and the violence is there. My concern is that of trying to stem the tide of the abuse that's occurring with our children. I think we have an obligation to have a safe environment. I think we have an obligation to do what we can to get meth manufacturing out of Oregon. And I thank you for the opportunity to be before you, and I welcome any questions before I go back to my committee.
Any questions for Representative Winters? Thank you, Representative Winters, for your testimony. Representative Walker, you had questions for Mr. Penn and Mr. Hauser.
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another one came up. And, gentlemen, if I could ask you, because you do testify in front of our committee a lot, could you, when you talk about a bill that came before us last session, give us the bill number on that so I can go back and see how I voted on it and maybe look the bill up? That would be helpful. So I'm going to ask you now, this bill last session, do you know what the bill number was?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, I wish you would ask that of Representative Winters. I can certainly find out. It was her bill. I don't know off the top of my head.
She probably forgot, too. We forget those numbers. I would appreciate that in the future. It just makes it easier for me. Then I had a couple questions for Mr. Penn and a couple for you.
Representative Walker, Mr. Lemon in the audience sign languaged us that the bill number was 3110.
HB3110. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Gary, when he remembers
that. Yeah, it is. You were explaining the sentencing guidelines, and I guess I was under a mistaken assumption that you didn't get good time under those, but I guess it's that you don't get good time under ballot measure 11 offenses. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, that's correct. You always, you qualify for good time under sentencing guidelines. It's only ballot measure 11 where good time is
okay.
Not available.
And the second thing is, I love that handy-dandy color chart that you have. Representative Prozanski had one last session, and he wouldn't share it. Do you think we could get one of those? Because I have one that's not colored, not laminated, and it would be very nice to have my own.
Unfortunately, the Lane County District Attorney's Office sells these statewide,
oh.
But I'm sure they will make one available since you're from the Lane County area.
And I know that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association has them, so I'll make sure that you get them.
That's where I get mine from.
Okay. Then I had a question, if I can read my notes, for Mr. Hauser. Oh, what's the recidivism rate on manufacturers? So if you're convicted of manufacturing methamphetamine, how many of those people, once they go and serve their time, come back out on the street and remanufacture?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, I have no idea.
Does Mr. Penn know the answer to that?
Ms. Chair and Representative Walker, I do not.
If someone had the answer, it would be great for me because it would be helpful to know if probation is working or if prison time is working, and if probation's not working, then I could be more supportive of this bill. I mean, not that I'm not, but this would help me understand where I'd like to go with that. Secondly, there is, I'm not sure which one it is. Oh, the one on the precursor chemicals, is that 2420?
Yeah.
Yes. A question I have about that one is, what if you have a user who simply is delivering those products to the manufacturer because he's going to get a better deal on the price of his drug, and he gets caught delivering that, and so you want the user to fall into that, even though he has no history of manufacturing? That's my concern with that, because I think those people are more helpful to put in probation, whereas the manufacturer, sometimes I believe they should just be thrown in the slammer for what they do.
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, again, this bill focuses only on manufacturing, and so a delivery is going to be classified as a Category 6. And so actually the people with the lowest criminal record, Categories I through F, that is a presumptive probation sentence. And it's only when we can prove manufacturing against the individual that it becomes a Category 8. And that's where Categories I, H, and G have this optional probation that this bill addresses.
But you do state in here that if you deliver the salts or the isomers, that puts you up into the higher level.
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, yes, but that would be a Category 6 delivery. You
okay.
Still have the crime. We're going to have to charge manufacturing to get it into a Category 8.
Okay.
That's the issue.
All right, great. Those are my questions for now. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Penn, the bill last session, I think, required mandatory minimum sentences for the manufacturing of amphetamines. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bowman, it started out as a 10-year sentence.
Yes.
And there was and obviously that had a substantial fiscal impact, and it was whittled down to have a minimal fiscal impact, and that's how you see it at this point.
If I may continue, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
That gets right to my next question. It's interesting when you start thinking like I do, huh? my question had to do with the fiscal impact. This bill says that it's directing $52,000 or $56,000, which would incarcerate one individual for a year. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how often do we think we would use this bill, and how many people in your county are arrested for manufacturing amphetamines per year?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bowman, this is not large numbers, and that's why it was restricted down to this. In my county, we do have, it depends, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we had a substantial lab in the rural area here. The federal guidelines for drugs are much more significant as far as sentencing. And so the large labs, if it is possible, we try to have those prosecuted federally. And people will receive 5 or 10 year minimums for this types of manufacture. So some of those cases in Oregon of manufacture go into the federal system and are paid by the federal government, incarcerated. Those that are not taken, because there's only a small quantity that can go into the federal system, they're going to be sentenced on the sentencing guidelines, and so it's going to be a Category 8. And I couldn't give you precise numbers, probably in a year. I think statewide we have 200 labs last year, something along those lines. How many of those went federally, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but I think most judges are going to look at this seriously, and they aren't going to give optional probation, and so that's why you see a small fiscal impact. But I think at this point it becomes a philosophical statement, and one that right now we aren't able to put dollars to, and so that's why it's been whittled down.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could ask, it would be helpful to find out from Lane County, Marion County, those counties, just approximately how many arrests like this they make per year. I believe this fiscal impact statement is inadequate to accommodate the people who will be prosecuted under this law. And so I have real concerns about being told it's not going to cost much, but if we had 200 labs just last year and we only prosecute 10% of those using this bill, then we're talking 20 individuals who would be in a state facility with no resources to accommodate them.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Representative Bowman. I guess I have two responses. One, I think we will be able to get some information that would be helpful to you on that issue, and it is an interesting question. The second is that both these bills have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which means that under any circumstances, Ways and Means will have to make a determination about whether or not they have the resources and able to move these bills to the floor.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't see that on these bills. They don't, because they're less than 60,000, they circumvent the Ways and Means process.
Well, I think the test is 50,000, as I recall.
That was what I thought.
Yeah, it's 50,000. So whether or not they've got a subsequent or whether I have to put them down there because of the rule, they'll both go to Ways and Means before they go to the floor.
As long as they go to Ways and Means.
Yeah, they won't hit the floor without going to Ways and Means. Further questions for either of these witnesses on this issue?
Yes.
Representative Walker.
Thank you. One more came to my mind. Representative Bowman sort of brought that out. I recall I used to court report for federal grand jury in the 80s, in the mid-80s, and that's about all we heard were these methamphetamine cases. And our county prosecuted a heck of a lot of them through the federal court. Who makes the decision when you go out and bust a lab up, who makes the decision to prosecute it under the federal system or the state system, and when is that decision made?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, if a federal agency is primarily involved in the investigation, such as the DEA or the FBI, that is going to be a federal case. And however, what you've seen in Oregon is a lot of cooperation between federal agencies and the U.S. Attorney's offices and local prosecutors and local interagency teams. For instance, in our six-county region, including Lane County and Marion County, we fund a prosecutor in the United States Attorney's Office that does cases from Yamhill, Polk, Marion, Lane, Lynn Benton. And we are able to get more cases into the federal system. However, you have to understand that the total number of criminal prosecutors in the state of Oregon is the same size, or roughly the same size, as my office, the Marion County DA's office, or the Lane County DA's office. And so only a certain number of those assistant U.S. attorneys prosecute narcotics cases. And so even though you would see a large number of these coming in the federal system, in comparison to the state system, it is small. So you try to pick those cases that comply with federal law and are the highest quantities, because clearly the most severe penalties would be ordered in the federal system. That's some of the criteria, but it is a joint decision. U.S. attorney has the ultimate decision on whether or not to take it.
Follow-up question, Mr.
Follow-up.
Chair. Thank you. So that's the designation of special U.S. assistant attorney, would be those from the local level who've been paired up to work in their office to help with these investigations?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, yes. However, that grant position that I told you about has an office, U.S. attorney, everyone thinks is a U.S. attorney, but is actually a deputy DA.
Yeah.
He doesn't really have a special designation.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's my intention, committee, to not work these bills in work session today, but to bring them back and have the work session at the same time we do the hearing on the wider hearing on the issue of methamphetamine. That'll give us, I think, a better context to consider the bills in work session.
And I'm going to ask at that point also, Mr. Lemon, if you'd be willing to be prepared at that time to discuss a little bit more some of the questions regarding the fiscal impact of these bills. So thank you very much. With that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2420 and 2419 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2413.
Put your hand over here.
No, it's okay, you won't miss.
You practice being a judge that way, Max. Okay, I hate these when we hear these together, isn't it?
It is our great pleasure to have Representative Shetterly appearing before us on this matter of obscene materials.
Obscene materials. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34, and a member of this august committee, subcommittee. You have before you House Bill 2413. It is born of a case that came out of the Court of Appeals last year that ruled unconstitutional ORS 17.065, which is a crime furnishing obscene materials to minors. And it's, I'll explain a little bit about how that happened. You have both a copy of ORS 167.065. That's the statute that in the case of State versus Maynard, the Court of Appeals ruled unconstitutional. And you also have some written testimony from me, written exposition on the bill and how the fix that is proposed by 2413 saves ORS 167.065 from its constitutional infirmity. In State versus Maynard, the Court of Appeals held that ORS 167.065, which makes it a Class A misdemeanor to furnish, and there's the operative word, furnish obscene materials to minors, violates Article 1 or Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution as an overbroad limitation on expression. I think the staff committee summary, the staff measure summary, points up a good example that truly under ORS 167.065, if an uncle gives a niece or a nephew who is a minor an art book that contains a picture of Michelangelo's David, that is technically a criminal offense under ORS 167.065 because it constitutes the furnishing to a minor of a picture of the human body that depicts nudity. The Court of Appeals, of course, consistent with a long line of Oregon case law has determined that such materials are protected under Article 1, Section 8 as an expression of free speech, and so that a statute that purports to make that a criminal offense, such conduct as that, would be unconstitutional. Now, in Maynard, the state tried to save ORS 167.065 by referring to ORS 167.085, which is the statute that is amended in House Bill 2413, because that statute creates an affirmative defense. If you look in subsection 3 of the statute that's before you, that statute creates an affirmative defense. If you look at the current language, that is, it is an affirmative defense that the defendant was charged with the sale, exhibition, or display of an item, those portions of which might otherwise be contraband, forming merely an incidental part or an otherwise non-offending whole and serving some legitimate purpose other than titillation. So in this case, the state would basically argue that, no, the gift book, an art book that's given that might contain a picture of Michelangelo's David is would not be subject to prosecution under the statute because it comes within this affirmative defense, and therefore this affirmative defense saves the statute. You couldn't be prosecuted. Well, the court said, though, that the operative word in subsection 3 of ORS 167.085 is sale, and so that a giving, let's say, of that gift book would still be a criminal offense, because the giving of a gift book that contains a picture of the Michelangelo's David is not a sale of that book. And so because there was a disconnect between the affirmative defense, which says sale, exhibition, or display, and the criminal statute itself, which is broader, which includes furnishing, which goes way beyond sale, that affirmative defense, in fact, did not save the underlying statute from constitutional infirmity, and so rendered the statute was still unconstitutional. This bill will reinstate the status of ORS 165.065 as a constitutional statute by aligning the affirmative defense with the language of the criminal statute, so that where the statute says it is a criminal offense to furnish these particular materials, the affirmative defense will say that it is also a defense if the furnishing constitutes material that's just an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending whole. So that's what this bill does. It aligns the affirmative defense with the statute to which it relates, and by so doing renders the charging statute, ORS 167.065, constitutional again, so the prosecutions may be brought into that statute. So it does.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly. I guess I have a general question about whether or not under the progeny of cases stemming from State versus Henry, if any of this area, if it's possible to save any of this area of obscene material issues, short of child pornography, which I think is the one place where the Supreme Court actually seems to still say that there are statutes with respect to obscenity that can be enforced. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, I guess I don't. Certainly the Court of Appeals invited a narrower fix. The Court of Appeals basically looked at sale versus furnishing and said that in order to save this statute, it would be necessary to interpret display, showing, and exhibition to encompass the full meaning of the verb furnish, and it did not go on to a full State versus Henry exposition on this thing. I guess there may be a case someday that brings us to that. I hate to concede that, and if the courts want to go that direction, I guess I'd rather leave it to them to do that than to us just to vacate the field. So my preference would be to make this narrower fix to save the statute according to the invitation, basically, of the Court of Appeals. And then if the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals someday wants to take on a broader challenge under Henry, let them do that.
Okay. Good answer. Any other questions for Representative Shetterly?
I have a question.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shetterly, is the ACLU... talk to you about this bill?
They've laughed at me about the bill.
I don't see them. I was looking and
Andrew.
Yeah.
No,
there.
I think there was some confusion. If you look at the bill, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, it looks kind of weird. To understand the bill, you really have to understand it in terms of the statute, the other statute that I've provided you this morning, and then how those two interrelate in light of the Maynard case.
Okay.
So I hope that.
And Andrea,
having heard this exposition now, is saying, yes, this is a good bill. It makes a lot of sense. We support it. Probably not. I would imagine the ACLU will be the bringers of the next case that invites the State versus Henry kind of challenge to a case like this. So I think this is not going to satisfy that issue. But it's not intended to. Again, as I said, it's not intended to satisfy that. It leaves open the opportunity someday that there will be a broader challenge to it. But I think for our purposes, solves our obligation to try to make the statutes workable, at least within the world within which we operate.
Representative Shetterly, do you recall the facts of the Maynard case?
Oh, Andrea has the opinion. She might.
Up.
Yeah, it's a huge case.
Come forward, please.
Well, we all know that lawyers talk too much, so you could probably condense it down to one page.
I was going to say, if you guys want a yes vote on this bill, you know.
Stop.
Should have lawyers stop talking about it.
For the record, Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the East Valley of Oregon. Actually, I'm not prepared to testify today. The Maynard opinion is only 80 pages long and has a complicated history, and we're certainly happy to address the committee at a later date on Maynard and its history. I think the representative is probably correct that we do oppose this. We don't think it's a fix to the overall problem and flaws of that statute, and that it does go to the content of expression. So, in brief, that.
Told you.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, just in one sentence, for what it's worth,
It's a remand back from a
it doesn't give us the factual
it's not a
details
very,
of the
yeah,
case.
We need to go back and look
okay.
at the...
Okay, all right. I just thought it might be interesting to put a perspective for the committee what it was the person was actually being charged with doing. Might be something that we can talk about at another time. Thank you very much. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2413, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2413.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2413 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2413 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Can you call the roll?
Well, oh, discussion, yes.
Discussion.
I'm sorry, I wasn't
okay.
thinking.
Right.
I'm going to support this to the full, but I may change my mind by Friday because I need a little more information than just simply that the ACLU opposes this bill. So I want to do a little more research.
Fair enough.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair, I could ask Resident Shirley a question. I'm just a little bit confused about the approach here. If in Maynard the statute was declared unconstitutional, and I haven't read any of this
yep.
stuff except for what you've heard this morning, why are we changing the affirmative defenses rather than the substantive act?
Thank you. The answer to that is that the affirmative defense is what saves the underlying statute. The statute says that it's a crime to furnish these
okay.
obscene materials. The affirmative defense says, but it's not a crime if what you furnished is part of an otherwise non-offending whole.
Okay, I see it now. Thank you.
Okay, we'll call the roll.
Representative Ackerman? Aye.
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 Representative
Shepherd?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative
Williams? Aye. House Bill 2413 will move to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Shetterly, would you please carry the bill?
I'd be glad to.
And now we'll open a work session on House Bill 2376.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2376 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
I appreciate the motion, Representative Bowman. I was thinking that I would ask counsel
sure.
To just sort of bring us up to speed. You should have in front of you, if you don't, we'll get them passed out, some materials related to both 2376 and 2377 from the parties. You'll recall, members, that this bill was one we heard between the juvenile departments and SCF regarding the issue of payment for witnesses and parties that are summoned. There was some disagreement, as I recall, between the parties as to what the actual facts were. I'm not sure that they've gotten any closer to agreement on the bill, but I think they've at least gotten closer to understanding what the situation is. And I think it would be helpful for the committee before we vote on the bills to bring the parties forward just briefly to address the issues. So with that, Kathy Ledesma from the SCF office.
Carl Morris.
And
I'm not sure it's Carl, I think we want to bring up. Come on forward, Kathy.
Yeah.
Steve, is it Steve Dye? Steve isn't here, though. It's. This is Steve. Okay, come on. All right. Why don't we start with you, Steve? Just bring us up to speed on what you were able to find out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen C. Dye. I'm the director of the Lynn County Juvenile Department here representing the Oregon Director Juvenile Department Directors Association.
Go ahead.
Before you, I believe that you have a document. There was some issues in regards to the termination of parental rights that I think that may be resolved. SEF has accepted the responsibility for the payment of those. However, the Directors Association's its position remains the same, that it is not the Juvenile Department's it should not be the Juvenile Department's responsibility to pay for the publications involving any dependency cases.
Okay.
That has not changed.
Now, my recollection was that there was some disagreement about who actually was paying. And I think we've resolved that, have we not?
Representative Williams, I'm Kathy Ledesma from SCF. And I think that we have resolved that the chart that's before you really describes administratively what happens, not statutorily what happens. And even though statutorily the juvenile departments have, under existing statute, the responsibility to pay for these activities in both termination of parental rights cases and in dependency cases. In reality, administratively, SCF has taken on voluntarily the responsibility for assuming those costs on termination of parental rights cases. Yes.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Yes, Mr. Myers.
Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, but without the change that we're asking in House Bill 2376, the state could still come to the counties and ask for reimbursement, and we would have no ability to refuse to pay.
Right.
And so we're asking that 2376 make that change in 419B 280 to allow the state to pay for those that they accept to pay, and to allow the judge to determine in other cases whether it's appropriate that the state pays or the county pays based on the involvement of either government.
Ms. Ledesma, if in fact currently on a voluntary basis FCF has taken over the payment with respect to termination of parental rights cases, and I'm trying to determine, is it 2376 is not only related to termination of parental rights cases. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It relates to all juvenile proceedings.
So which portion, for example, of the $112,000 fiscal, you're already doing the termination of parental rights cases. Are any of those factored into the $112,000 fiscal?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have prepared some testimony, realizing this is a work session and not a public hearing. We nonetheless did prepare some testimony that gives a breakout of those costs. On the back on page 2, I think that was passed out to you, the second paragraph down, in calendar year 2000, we paid for termination of parental rights cases $100,000 and some change in some of the witness fees statewide for TPR proceedings. So the $112,000 that was previously referenced for dependency proceedings, this $100,000 obviously wouldn't be included in that $112,000. The $112,000 has been recalculated based on actual activity from the last year. The estimate has been modified. It now is $80,000 to $85,000 a year for the activities described in 2376 and 2377, $80,000 to $85,000 annually. And of that amount, the is 90% of those costs relate to 2376, which would be what, 70 some thousand dollars.
Okay, let me ask you just a question of policy, Ms. Ledesma. Recognizing that your objection to this bill has to be purely on the issue of its fiscal impact on your budget, from a policy standpoint, do you have any disagreement with giving the court essentially the discretion, as the statute would read with the amendments in 2376, that the expenses so authorized shall be borne by the party issuing the summons or requesting the court to issue the summons?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do have an additional objection that is cited in our testimony. Our primary objection, of course, is financial. It's not included in the governor's budget. And again, if that were only $1, we would be in a position to say that. Now, under ORS 419A012, we do believe that the County Juvenile Department Director is responsible for furnishing information to the court, such information as the court needs. That does not say only in delinquency cases. It does not specify only in delinquency cases. And so we do believe that under that statute that the juvenile department does retain responsibility for those costs.
Okay. Mr. Myers, do you have anything to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in regards to that question, again, without the changes in the statute that are required by 2376 and 2377, we would pay all costs, whether or not the court required them, because they're in the statute. We don't have any problem with the 419A.012, but it says as the court requires. Making the changes that we are requesting in 2376 and 2377 will not take away the, in fact, it will enhance the court's ability to require whoever should be paying for those costs to be paid. The court still will have the court, quite honestly, now will have the discretion to assess those costs to the appropriate party. Under the current statutes, the county must pay. It is in the statute. And so to, not only to conform to what is the practice with SCF now, where they voluntarily pay on termination of parental rights cases, at least in most instances, Mr. Dye here received a bill from SCF and paid a bill on SCF for summons that were issued in a termination case. So apparently some of those bills slipped through the cracks. But we'd like, again, just to have the requirement in the statute that the county's paid removed, so again, that if there is an argument as to who would be the appropriate party, that can be left up to the judge, who would know the facts of the case, know whether somebody was at fault for incurring those costs, and can assess them appropriately instead of just having them automatically turned over to the county. And again, if you look at the chart in both the instances, SCF and a state official concur, the counties are left out of the decision as to who shall be subpoenaed, who shall be witnessed. So we're essentially under the current system paying costs that we have no control over. Mm-hmm. And we would simply like that changed, and 2376 and 2377 do that.
Okay. We have a motion on the table from Representative Bowman, who has been kind and not requiring me to call the question yet. Discussion, Representative Walker.
I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has anybody asked the judges whether they want to make this kind of decision? Maybe judges don't want to get involved in this fee fight.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, we have not asked the judges, but it is, as pointed out by Ms. Ledesma, that portion is in the statute. That the counties shall assist as the court requires. And I think that's appropriate, that on some of these cases the county should be involved, but on a lot of cases the county is not involved in any portion of of these proceedings, except when it comes to paying the bill.
Yeah, please come forward. This always feels like we're deciding a family squabble. I want you to know that.
Mr. Chair,
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the director of the Juvenile Court Programs Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. And yes, we did ask the judges, by way of posting the bill in our legislative database and asking for comment. And the response of the judges was that they didn't need to take a position on it. It was a public policy decision for the legislature to make in terms of your belief about whether the juvenile court, the juvenile departments should remain involved in these cases.
Thank you for that helpful testimony.
Very helpful, yes.
Threw it back in our lap.
Yeah, once again, helpful testimony. All right, we have the question of Representative's motion to move House Bill 2376 to Ways and Means, no, I'm sorry, to the full committee for likely referral to Ways and Means. Any objection? Hearing none, the bill moves to the full committee. Carrier will be...
Just for the full.
Just for the full, because it won't go. Representative Bowman, do you want to carry it to the full? Thank you. I'll now open the work session on House Bill 2377. You'll recall, colleagues, that this is the bill that ends the requirement that counties pay for witness fees, mileage, costs, and travel expenses of witnesses. The State Office for Services for Children and Families issues a summons for in a dependency action. This bill had an indeterminate fiscal impact on it, and I'm not sure if there is any additional information with respect to that today. Please, Ms. Ledesma.
Yes, Chair Williams, members of the committee, we did do initial fiscal analysis or an additional fiscal analysis on this, and previously I did state when we were discussing House Bill 2376. That the total cost of these two bills looked to be, or impact on SCF was $80,000 to $85,000 annually, $170,000 for the biennium, 10% of that, so about $17,000 for the biennium, relates to the cost described in House Bill 2377.
Okay, thank you. You'll note on the fiscal in the comments. It already points out that SCF is already paying the fees and expenses of subpoenas that they request in Multnomah County. So at least in Multnomah County, they've already begun assuming these costs, and it has a total all funds impact of $10,000 with a $6,100 impact to the general fund and a $3,900 impact to the federal, what appear to be federal funds. Discussion of the committee? Any questions of the two people we have before us in work session? With that, the chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2377 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2377 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, bill moves to the full committee.
Carry.
Carrier will be Representative Bowman since she's already talking about the other one. So that is, I believe, our agenda today, colleagues. Thank you for your hard work and appreciate your help. Committee is adjourned.
I'll see you on the floor.
Yeah,
would you please?
Okay.
About what we find out and see what's all the doing, you know.
Would you see it?